Let's make it happen, Captain!
From deep inside the Death Star, I'm Larry Larson.
And I'm Gov Maharaj.
Welcome back to Defrag. All right, so you're back. You're done being sick. Are you still sick?
I'm still in the process of getting over being sick. Every now and again, I'll just hack up a lung and...
Hopefully you're not contagious.
No, I'm good. I should be good now.
Excellent.
Yeah, I was really... I don't usually get sick. You know, I'll get sick maybe once every couple, 3 years.
Yeah.
And apparently my time was up.
Well, I knew you were really sick because I'd send you an email and you wouldn't write back for like 10 minutes.
Well, so. I took time off, you know, which, again, is not something that I really like to do. And, you know, I was just sleeping during the entire day because it's draining.
Yeah. So did you change your oof message that you... aren't actually on 24/7.
Yeah, I changed it to, you know, find somebody else because I'm not going to answer you.
All right, first question from Robert. I recently needed to migrate hard drives. I can't remember if I used Windows Backup Restore feature or if I used Robocopy for a combination. If I end up with a C Restore folder full of my old stuff, I set the ACLs properly, move files around, and then tried to delete the ones I didn't need. When I tried to delete C-Restore, I couldn't. It seemed to be because I had an infinite, maybe self-referential application data directory a few levels down from the top directory. I'd like to get rid of that directory, though I know it's probably not harming my system. What do you have to say here?
Yeah, so the first problem was using Robocopy to back up your system.
Yeah.
Robocopy is not... it's not aware of certain mitigations that we have in the OS for application compatibility reasons. Mm-hmm. We have various junctions in the OS in order for apps to be able to reference old locations that don't exist anymore that have been repointed to new OS locations. In order to do that, you know, we do some file system tricks. You know, you've noticed that if you open up Explorer, you go to the C drive, you see the documents and settings. This is what existed back in XP, mm-hmm. right? And you try and go there. It's access denied. The only reason that you're seeing this is because I have show files, show hidden files.
Show everything.
Show everything. Normally people wouldn't see this.
Yeah.
Now, the thing of it is that applications can still see it regardless of what Explorer shows. So, you know, if an app goes, I want to save to the hard-coded location of documents and settings versus the environment variable of your profile path, what'll happen is that it gets automatically redirected from documents and settings to your user's directory, your user, documents, my documents. And here's another one that is an access deny. The My Documents link is another one that's been repurposed, has been sent to a different location. Now, the problem with things like Robocopy is that it doesn't know all of this stuff.
Yeah.
And there are some self-referential links that normally users will never see. Robocopy is unfortunately not all that smart. It just goes, walks the file system, and just copies as needed. And that's kind of how you end up in this mess. You need to use the Windows Backup and Restore feature or another third-party utility that has been designed for Windows Vista and higher in order to handle these types of links. You know, they're specifically designed to ignore these types of junctions.
Mm-hmm.
In order to delete them, there are some utilities out on the internet to go through using Win32 file paths that can understand these folders and delete them properly. The other thing that you can do is, it's kind of hacky, but you can use the subst command, S-U-B-S-T, in order to remap some of these lower level directories to a drive letter, and then go to the drive letter, and then you can start deleting. It's kind of like taking a chunk of the file system and rerouting it. That's another method to go through and delete these directories that, you know, you'll never get access to normally. They don't really harm anything, but if they have, you know, information sitting there, you wouldn't normally be able to get to them. But that's a simple method of going rerouting these directories. And you can use subst repeatedly, recursively, and delete low-level folders.
Cool. Okay. All right, next question. Both WinDVD Pro 11 and PowerDVD 9 refused to play my Inception Blu-ray disc and complained about content protection. He recently got a Blu-ray drive. Shortly thereafter, he installed WinDVD, successfully played Moneyball Blu-ray disc. Unfortunately, his hard drive failed, so he got a new one, installed Windows 7 and WinDVD again, bought Inception on Blu-ray, tried playing it, but complained about content protection. Uninstalled WinDVD and installed PowerDVD, same problem. Also ran CyberLink's Blu-ray advisor program, which claimed his Blu-ray disc was ready in every category except for video connection type, digital, without HDCP.
So you know what the problem is?
DRM?
No, he was trying to watch Inception.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it was probably a virtual Blu-ray player.
Yeah, it was folding in on itself.
It was folding in on, no. But yeah, the real reason was that last error that he got was the video connection type of HDCP not present. Mm-hmm. You need to have a fully content protected pipeline for playing a lot of the Blu-ray discs out there.
And this one, we went back and forth, and it turned out he was using a CRT that had HDMI, which I didn't think. We were like, really, a CRT? And I looked it up. There were a handful of them that
apparently
had HDMI.
Yes, it had HDMI.
But not HDCP. Apparently.
But it was not HDCP compatible. Yeah. And you have to have, it's actually rather complex. You have to have the video drivers HDCP, which sometimes beta drivers are not.
Yeah.
You have to have the monitors HDCP compliant. You have to have a cable that
will... Are there cables that aren't HDCP compliant?
There are, in the sense that if you're trying to translate HDMI across a DVI cable back to HDMI, you might have some problems. So if there are converters that are in the way.
That's true. I didn't even think about that, because I was wondering about this when we were troubleshooting the problem with them. I was thinking, and I looked it up, and I couldn't find anything. Is there any HDMI cables that wouldn't be compliant? But I guess that if you're, we do have some cables here in the studio that go from DVI to HDMI, so that would be a case where it's not going to work.
Well, it definitely adds some complexity to it.
Yeah.
You also have to worry about not just the video drivers, but codecs that are installed on the system. Mm-hmm. It may interfere with the protected pipeline.
Yeah.
It's all really rather complex, annoying. In order to make sure that everything is working properly at all times. Because you might, you know, have another third-party application that gets installed that interferes, but you'd never know, right? Because it's not all tied together. Things are working great one day, you install something, the next day you don't use a Blu-ray for months on end, and then boom, there's a problem. And it's really difficult to troubleshoot. There's not a lot that one can do about it, unfortunately.
Yeah.
The best thing that I could possibly say is complain to the movie studios that they have these restrictions, that, you know, when you buy the media and you're not properly able to use it, is, you know, it's not good for the consumer.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. All right, next question from Philip Verbot, for Bo, one or the other. I don't have a question, but I just wanted to say thanks to Gove. I find myself using the phrase, let's make it happen, Cap'n, more and more at work and among friends. So, yeah, thanks for that.
Puts a smile on most people's faces.
Yeah, you're welcome, Philip. That's Gove's little contribution to the show there. from Cliff Brooks. Hey, guys. I recently purchased a Samsung Series 7 Slate with 128-gig SSD. After installing my must-have software, there's not a lot of storage space left. Yeah, we've talked about this before. And I bought a 32-gig microSD card and tried to move my My Documents directory to it, but was unable to. Is there a way to move My Documents folder to a microSSD? Thanks, and keep up the amazing work, guys.
Now, the microSD, depending on how it's showing up on your system, may or may not be allowed to be a library location. Mm-hmm. But in a more generic sense, you know, you can set it up. The easiest way that I found in order to not use up space on your disk, on your SSD necessarily for documents, is to not move your My Documents folder, is to add an additional location to your library, and then you can delete the old location if you really wanted to. Because most everything, at least through Windows applications nowadays, will use the library location as the default save location. And it makes it a lot easier to like add and remove locations without having to actually change the the mappings in your OS.
Yeah, it makes it super simple. I did this last night on a laptop, and so if you typically have like videos, which would be one of the things that would take up a lot of space, mm-hmm. you can just go to the videos section, your library, the video library, right-click, properties, and then there's a list of locations. Add the new one,
yep.
remove the others, and you should be good there.
This is exactly how I set up my machine at home, especially for my pictures. Is I have my pictures backed up on the server.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've got a nice fast link, so I rather would not have to worry about pictures on my local machine, and when I dump stuff off my camera, it just goes right to the server. Mm-hmm. And if I'm going to browse, it just goes directly to the server, and everything that I have to do with pictures, it just saves it to the server location. I never have to worry about the location on the local machine.
Great. All right, next question from Martin. Hi, I'm running on SSD drive, 128 gig with 16 gig of RAM, but then the problem is that the page file and the Hyper file gets really around 28 gig currently. Is there a way I can decrease the size of these files?
So for the Hyper file, that one does need to be the size of your RAM.
Yeah.
But it does compress when it's actually saving it, when you're actually hibernating, it does not just take all the RAM and dump it as a 16 gig file. It'll compress it to what's actually needed. Now, for the page file, you know, we've talked about this on a number of different occasions. By default, Windows will take 1.5 times your RAM,
yeah,
which is, you know, rather large. It'll be 24 gig in this case. Mm-hmm. And most of the time, you probably don't need that as your page file.
Yeah.
You're better off, as we said, running performance testing, you know, what your normal load is on your system for about a week, mm-hmm. and then set your page file accordingly. Now, you could easily get away with, if you're a regular user, and again, I'm kind of extrapolating, I'm totally generalizing off of, you know, a simple machine, normal consumer workload. If you're doing things like video rendering, you know, some high-end stuff, then don't go by this next recommendation.
Yeah.
You probably go with like an 8 gig page file or a 4 gig page file. Probably don't need, you know, 16 or beyond that. Mm-hmm. But you really do have to run your machine and figure out how much page file usage you're actually using.
Yeah.
And then take that number, multiply it by 1.5. So if your general workload across the week is, say, 2 gigs.
Yeah.
Right? So make it 3. Mm-hmm. You know, make it 4. If you really want it to be, you know, conservative. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, a 4-gig page file, that's a lot better than a 16-gig page file.
So you talked in the past about how you could roll it back a little bit, test it for a while, mm-hmm. put it back, you know, a little bit further.
Oh, yeah, you're not set in stone when you set the page
so
file.
So if you roll it back, how do you know if it's getting wobbly? And you should probably increase it a little bit.
You'll actually get warnings. You know, you'll get the little yellow yield sign in the corner saying, you know, you're system is running low on virtual memory.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the system really telling you up front, hey, better change this now.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you know, you're going to see a lot of disk thrashing. You're going to see systems or applications not being as responsive.
Yeah.
And basically, your page file will complain.
Cool. Okay. All right, next question from Dave. Love the show. I learned lots and never miss it. I download the Windows 7 dynamic theme that sends you two new photos from Bing every week, updated automatically through an RSS feed. Something must have gone wrong because I never got the upload of the images, and now after 30 seconds, my screen goes blank. Changing back to my old theme doesn't help. As long as I keep working, typing, moving the mouse, etc., the screen stays lit. But if I stop working when reading a long document, for example, it shuts off after a minute. And then I have to move the mouse or tap the key to turn it back on using a Dell Inspiron laptop, and I download the new video drivers, but there doesn't seem anything to help. Running in safe mode has the same problem. Any idea what's happening? So the first thing I'd say is, you know, check your power settings, because that sounds like a power setting on the laptop. And you asked if he was running on battery.
Yeah, because if you run on battery, by default, the RSS feed will stop.
Yeah.
When we went back and forth on this, when we actually found out that it was the blank screensaver that was being set. Mm-hmm. The other thing, you know, to check is your monitor off. Now, my personal views on screensavers is that they're useless.
Yeah.
You know, I tend to be a, you know, person that cares about power draw. So, you know, I will set very low timeouts on things.
This is where we go two different directions because
yeah, you
I
love your
screensavers. I mean, dude, we're at a crossroads here. We've got high resolution screens. We've got great processors. We've got, you know, a lot of cool things going on here. I want the coolest screensaver of all time. I want data visualizations. I want, you know, eye candy. So I like that kind of thing. And I also run two Westinghouse LCDs at home that get burned in. So I don't want that to happen. And I really am not a big energy conscious person where I want black screens in front of me. Because the thing is, in my office, screens are pretty much where I get most of the light in my room. So when they go black, I'm sitting in the dark. So I like to see my screens. And so I'm big on screensavers, but that's my two cents.
Well, you know, I can totally understand that. The only time I'm ever sitting in front of the computer is when I'm actually trying to interact with it.
Yeah.
So I'm rarely ever just, you know, looking at it, you know, in awe. but yeah, for folks like that, I prefer to run things like the folding at home style screensavers. You know, if it's going to be showing stuff, I'd rather it be somewhat useful.
Yeah.
Now, if you get a data visualization where it was just showing you data visualization and also doing folding at home style stuff, you'd be like one of the perfect people to, to use
that. Yeah, that would be awesome. But I would like to see, like, you know, news feeds, social media updates, stuff like that that just pops up.
You want a mashup.
And I want to see it in a very visual, eye candy way. I want just a grid or something like that. I want.
Yeah, I mean, you probably don't like boring RSS feeds, do you?
No, not really. I mean,
I like
a little pizzazz to it. So, you know, show me some eye candy. Make it cool looking.
So, you know, here's a shout out for you, you know, garage developers out there. Create a fun eye candy data visualization thing. You know, like, what is hot news trends that are, you know, going around? And, you know, there's this new thing coming out. I don't know if some of you have heard about it. It's the next version of the operating system. For Windows.
I might have saw an article on that, yeah.
Somewhere, might have heard about that. You know, it's a great new platform to, you know, try out those types of things. A full screen application that's showing you a whole bunch of data. I mean, it's kind of one of the things that is going to be pretty strong, I think, in the next few years with the next OS.
Make me proud. We'll mention it on Pick of the Week. And if there's one out there that I just don't know about, mention it in the comments. I'll go check it out. And if it's cool, we'll do a Pick of the Week on it. All right, next question from Pedro. Hey, guys. I'm having some problems installing the webcam on my machines. Wondering if you could suggest something. I have tried different cameras, both from Microsoft and Logitech, but always get the errors attached. I'm running Windows 7 64-bit Pro SP1. I get the error message in Skype and Windows Live Movie Maker saying that the camera might be in use by another application. But I can't tell what it might be. I can send you screen captures the error message. Thanks very much, Pedro.
I've only ever seen this a couple of times, and it's usually the value-added software. And it's almost always been on a system that has an embedded webcam.
Yeah.
So what you might want to do is go through and figure out what value-added software, additional applications like UCam might have been auto-started with the system.
Yeah.
And, you know, you can go check this out with SysInternals auto runs. You can use msconfig to see what's starting up with the system. Go through, start disabling stuff. You can try booting up into safe mode, see if you can get a similar result. I mean, if all else fails, you can completely uninstall all of the webcam software that you have and then reinstall it.
Okay, cool. Is there anything you can look at in the logs to see what might be tying up the camera?
That's a good question. I don't know specifically what logs Skype and Windows Live Movie Maker might produce. You check the event log, obviously.
Yeah.
You know, that would be one location. But they may all detect it differently.
Okay, cool. All right, next question. Can you explain the difference between a router, a switch, and a hub, and how they should typically be set up in a home with cable modem?
Okay, let's talk about first the difference between a switch and a hub, because those are the two closely related devices. Hubs were very popular back in the 80s and 90s, you know, obviously earlier than that. Hubs, basically what they are is they would take, a connection, an Ethernet connection, and it would split up the bandwidth evenly across all the different ports. So if you had an 8-port hub that was running at 100 megabit per second, it would take the 100 megabit per second feed and then chop it up evenly among the 8 ports.
Yeah.
So you'd never get a full 100 megabit per second connection for any machine that was connected.
Mm-hmm.
And this is, in a work group style setting where you had 8 machines connected, you have machine A talking to machine B through the hub, it would never actually be connected, you'd never get the full bandwidth of 100 megabit per second.
Yeah.
Now the difference between that and a switch is that you have the same 8-port device, same 100 meg per second bandwidth, except each machine would get the full 100 meg per second connection as it was talking to each other machine.
Yeah.
So if you have machine A talking to machine B, it would get 100 megabit per second. If then you started a new connection from machine A to machine C, it would get 100 megabit per second connection. But it didn't, you don't automatically get 800 megabit per second all the time because you have 8 ports. It doesn't work that way.
Yeah.
It multiplexes the ports.
Mm-hmm.
Now a router is a device that essentially says, I'm going to create not just a dumb connection. I'm not going to allow all the ports to talk to each other just randomly and chatty.
Yeah.
A router says, I'm going to be able to partition particular sections, virtual networks, essentially, from other virtual networks used on the same device. So what you could do with a router is say, I want these 3 ports to be able to talk to each other, and say you have an 8-port router. You have 3 ports on a virtual network being able to talk to each other. You have another 3 ports on another virtual network able to talk to each other. And if you wanted both of them to talk, it would be, you could control how they would talk to each other. A router would also typically have a DHCP server, so it could hand out IP addresses. Neither a switch or a hub would have those.
Yeah.
Routers are just more intelligent, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
So in terms of lowering intelligence devices, you'd have a router, a switch, and a hub.
Yeah.
Hubs are the dumbest. Switches are a little bit smarter. You can get some switches that are that have some more smarts to them. They're called smart switches, right? And you can have them have virtual networks created on them so that they can partition. They won't have a DHCP server, which is typically relegated to routers and dedicated DHCP servers.
Yeah.
But you're able to partition and handle your bandwidth better on those smart switches. Those are typically significantly more expensive than what you'd ever see in a home. So, in terms of this question, what you'd have with a cable modem, so if you have the feed coming in, you'd have that coming into your cable modem, which is actually a form of a router.
Yeah.
You'd have your cable modem plugged into your, your wireless router, if it has embedded wireless, or if not, it's just wired.
Usually you've got a router, it's a wireless router, and it's got a few ports on the back.
Exactly. Like, most home ones have 4 ports on the back, and you plug in your cable modem router into the WAN port of your home router, and then you plug in all of your other computers into the other 4 ports and your other wireless devices. And that's your typical home setup, because at that point, your router behind the cable modem will have things like stateful packet inspection, built-in firewall, which is really what you want. You never want your computer to have direct access to the internet through the cable modem, because depending on who your provider is, what type of cable modem it is, it might not have the best security.
Yeah.
And you'll have, people hammering on your network. Port scanning, which that's why you'll want to have another router set up so that you're a little bit buffered.
Mm-hmm. So in that case, if you have your Wi-Fi router hooked up to your cable modem, and let's say you don't have enough ports on the back of that, you need more, would you fill up the ports on the back of that router first, or would you just plug your switch into the back of that router and plug everything into the switch?
I would fill some of the ports up on the router itself, and then
probably with the most important machines, ones that you want to have the best connections with.
Well, see, the thing that you'd want to do, right, is if you're having machines talk to each other, you want to have them on the same switch,
yeah,
if you can. So you can hook up, say, 3 machines onto the router that's connected to your cable modem, and those are going to be the ones that are talking to each other the most. Mm-hmm. And then you can have a crossover cable going from your router to another switch, and then you can have machines on that other switch, and they'll be talking to each other.
Yeah.
Now, what you would typically have then in that situation is, as long as there isn't a lot of cross-talking between switches, then you're good.
Yeah.
Or if you only ever have one machine from one side talking to one machine from the other side, you're also good. But you want to try and partition as much in order to not be chatty across that one connection that you mm-hmm. have between the two, the router and the switch.
Yeah. Excellent. All right, next question. Is there a way to have a password just for Outlook that I have to put in each time I start to keep people from using, keep people using my computer from being able to open my mail and look at it? So, yeah, that's a good question. If you have, say you keep your computer logged in at home.
And you don't use multiple user accounts.
Yeah, you don't use multiple, you're a bad person. You don't use multiple user accounts. But you want to keep your email protected. Mm-hmm. What's a way to do that? And so I've got an article that'll talk about how to do this. And the way that you do it is on the PST that you have for your Outlook, you can just put in a new password and then don't click Save Password. And then every time you start Outlook before it loads your email, it's going to ask you for that password. And,
right.
Yeah, so here you go. Simple instructions. Easy as eating lettuce. So
this is, of course, if you're using Outlook.
If you're using Outlook, yeah.
I mean, if you're using webmail, I think...
Then you have to log in anyway.
You're golden
there.
So that
would bypass that. Next question. If I want to verify a particular email address exists, how do I do that without using Telnet? Well, this is interesting because I didn't know that you could use Telnet to discern if an email address is valid or not. So tell us about that.
Yeah, you could connect to a mail server, at least back in the day, you could connect to various mail servers with Telnet, and you could verify whether an email account existed and if that email
and
account
matched.
Will
it tell you if it exists, or does it just tell you that you had a successful delivery?
No, it'll just say that there's a user account with that
okay.
name there. That's really all it'll tell you.
Okay.
But, I mean, we were talking about this, and you have an interesting setup where something like this would never work.
Yeah, so I host my personal website through GoDaddy. I've had the same email address, you know, for over 16, 17 years now. But I have my my email set up, so you can write me at larry@greengem.com. You can write foo@greengem.com, and they all come into my main email address.
Mm-hmm. And so you essentially have every email address as a valid email
address.
Yeah,
it's a fallover, so if you send anything for any address, it comes. And the reason I do that is for spam, because if I go sign up at, you know, whatever, Ford Sync, you know, I'm registering my car, I'll use FordSync@greengem.com. And then if I ever start getting spam that's coming into FordSync@greengem.com, I know that they used my email address. And so it gives me a way to discern that, and then I can, you know, block those if I want.
Right.
So, yeah, that's why I do that.
Yeah, I think that's extremely handy. I wish more services would actually provide for that.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, that would be somewhat difficult.
Yeah,
if you have your own domain, it's easy. You know, Hotmail can't really do that.
Yeah.
But it would be, you know, extremely useful for customers where, for different service providers, if they could provide that kind of service, you know, subdomains.
And so, in my case, would it say that that's a valid email address, or would it just
not
say,
using the Telnet?
Yeah,
because it would not. It would not work because every email address for you is valid.
Yeah. All right. Next question. I know how to change default save type in Windows XP Paint, but how do you change the default saving type in Windows 7 Paint from PNG to JPEG? So this is an easy one. If you bring up Paint, I'll show you how to do this. It's very cool. So you got MS Paint. You want to be able to save instead of a PNG as a JPEG. Just click on that blue drop-down, save as, and then whatever one you want, let's say you want JPEG, you can right-click and do Add to Quick Access Toolbar. And now you have a little icon up there. So if you want to save this as a JPEG, you can just click that icon, and it'll automatically start saving this as a JPEG. You can add PNG, you can add, you know, GIF up there, and then whatever file type you want to save as, you have a button for that.
Cool. I kind of like that one a little bit more because, you know, there's sometimes where you don't always want it to be a particular type.
Yeah.
So this one just gives you a faster access to the choices.
Yeah.
Which is very handy.
Yep. So there you have it. All right. Next question. It's a tip of the week. So this is a tip of the week, how to set your command window to a different font. For this instance, Consolus, which was one of the Vista fonts created to have high readability for developers.
Right. So by default, this is what CMD looks like. And it is a raster font.
And how did you get to that?
Oh. Just right-click the title bar and go to Properties.
Okay.
And you can choose Consolus. Now, default 12 is kind of small, but setting it to 16 is a much nicer-looking font.
Mm-hmm. And does that save it permanently?
It does for the CMD window.
Okay.
So if you go... Boom.
There you have it. Cool.
It's, you know me, I'm not too much of a customizer for my system.
Yeah.
I just tend to use what's available only because I'm connecting to so many different machines all the time.
Yeah.
If I do a lot of customization on my own machine, when I go to a different one that doesn't have any of my customizations, it's too jarring.
Yeah.
I mean, I used to do that. I used to customize it all over the place. Different color backgrounds, different titles, everything. Then I go to a different machine, it's like, wait, what? It's not working the way that I expect to do. So I have to train myself to say, okay, I need to know what's there by default, because anything that I add and that I get used to and that's not there anymore, it jars. It's too jarring for my workflow.
Yeah.
So I tend to customize.
This is where we part ways, because I customize the heck out of all my machines, and I carry around a thumb drive in my pocket. And on that thumb drive, I've got a directory of the pictures that I like on my backgrounds, and I've got a text file that tells how I like to customize each machine with steps to walk through it. So I'll do stuff like I'll add fences, because I really like being able to double-click on my desktop to see icons and to hide them again. So for me, fences is just a no-brainer. I do it every time. And there's a few other things. I just have this text file that's a list of the things I like to do to customize my machine. It just helps me walk through when I get a new machine, so...
You know, that's the great thing about Windows is it's to each his or her own.
Yeah.
You know, you can customize it, which is great. You know, when you're on a single machine all day or, you know, a couple of machines all day, you do want to customize it.
Yeah.
You know, it makes a lot of sense to be able to.
Yeah.
And that's a great power of this operating system.
Awesome. All right, next is Pick of the Week, Microsoft Script Explorer for Windows PowerShell Beta 1. Yeah, so if you're into PowerShell, like Gove here.
I do love my PowerShell.
This is pretty awesome. Tell us a little bit about this.
So this will allow you to easily find various scripts that people have written from the Script Center repository, Bing search. Like PowerShell, people are creating all sorts of different commandlets and new functionality. It's one of the easiest ways to add functionality for a scripting environment.
Yeah.
You know, back in the day, people would use VBScript, but it wasn't quite as nice, I think, in terms of the plug-in ability as PowerShell is, being able to write different commandlets and plug it in, sign them, distribute them. I found PowerShell to be significantly more powerful than VB ever was. And while I use command scripts fairly often still, just to the different environments that I'm in. PowerShell is definitely the way to administer your machine going forward.
It's interesting. There's so many different things you can do with PowerShell.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is one good way to just walk through and see some different examples of the types of things that you can do with it. And so that might give you some ideas and place to start if you want to use that kind of code to do your own scripts.
Oh, absolutely. And, I mean, PowerShell really exemplifies the there's more than one way to do it kind of thing.
Yeah.
There are so many different ways to get similar results but very custom results with PowerShell, you know, based on transforming data as an intermediary translator, as outputting reports, you know, if you're having to administer various machines in a enterprise environment, even in a home environment. You know, I use PowerShell in a home environment to go and get various statistics from my different machines out there.
Yeah.
It's infinitely handy. I keep learning new things about it every day.
Cool. All right, that's the show for this week. If you'd like to contact us, you can write us at defragshow@microsoft.com. Leave comments in the show notes, and we can get to those. But we prefer a email so that we can go back and forth on a problem if we have to. And we will see you next week.